Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Good to be back with another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. And today is Tuesday, which means it is budget day, budget night. The budget will be released this evening, and we're going to have a chat about the budget. And of course, Tony, 2014 budget that was delivered by the Abbott government that set the scene for fiscal consolidation. And we're also going to be talking about the situation with the Victorian Liberal Party and Moira Deeming and that, what that means for the future of the centre-right in Victoria. Tony, great to be with you as always. Let's kick off with the budget. It's budget night. The reports are that there will be a modest surplus reported tonight, but deficits into the future. Tony, let's just start by getting your assessment of the current budgetary situation and what you think it means for Australia.
The surplus, if that's what we get, is the result of serendipity rather than economic reform. And what we need from all governments is a constant focus on economic reform, not because we obsess about economics, but because economic reform is constantly needed to improve the real situation of Australian families. We need a more efficient economy so that wages can go up, so that productivity can increase, so our exports are more competitive, so our society ultimately is better and fairer. Economic reform is not just something that you do to please economists. Economic reform is something that you do to make Australians better off. And the problem with this budget is that there'll be a lot of boasting about how well the government's doing. But in fact, any surplus that appears 14 months into a government's life essentially belongs to the former government, if it belongs to anyone. But this is really, as I said, an adventitious surplus. It's basically a fluke brought about by unusual circumstances, continuing sky-high resource prices. And I guess the paradox for all of this, Dan, is that it's high coal prices, it's high gas prices, and these are precisely the resources that this government wants to see kept in the ground.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. Look, let's go to 2014 and your budget. That was, I think, a significant budget. You talked about reform. That budget did contain a lot of proposed economic reform. Some of that didn't get through the Senate, but nonetheless, your government put up, I think, an important budget, whether it was red tape, whether it was to do with getting electricity prices down, reforming taxes. So tell us about, you know, take us behind the scenes of the sort of the leadership that you provided in 2014 and how you went about thinking about our economic challenges at that time.
Well, the most important budget any government delivers is its first, because your first budget sets the tone for everything that follows on. And I thought it was very important that the incoming coalition government send a clear signal to the public that we weren't going to be a big spending government, that we were going to be an economic reforming government, and that we did believe that in the end, other than the absolute essentials, we should do our best to leave money in people's pockets, because I am a much better judge of what my money should be spent on than the government is. Now, plainly, we need to defend the nation, we need to run the courts, we need to provide essential services. There's a certain amount of transfer payments that just have to happen. But you should always be asking yourself in government, is this really necessary? Is this really good value? And I think that all too often, since 2014 and 2015, instead of asking itself is this really necessary? There's been an assumption on the part of government, whenever a problem comes along, that the best response is bigger government, more spending, more intrusion into people's lives. And I just think that's wrong. And it certainly shouldn't be the instinct of Liberal governments. And frankly, the best Labor governments, in this case, the Hawke-Keating government, didn't take the attitude that government is always the answer. Often government is the problem.
You know, that's quite right, Tony. I just wanted to ask you something about sort of, I guess, more of a political question, which is the coalition typically sees itself as having an advantage when it comes to national security and the economy. Mm-hmm. Now, Labor has delivered on some important AUKUS agreements, seems to be doing a reasonable job in that space.
Yeah.
Now is looking like it'll deliver a budget surplus, which in the eyes of many people on the street will be a big tick for their economic management. The coalition, I understand it was COVID, but they did preside over an enormous increase in government spending and debt. Is there now a risk that the coalition is essentially being edged out of its main strength areas as the community sees it?
These are very early days, Dan. And yes, I agree with you that the Albanese government hasn't made too many mistakes when it comes to defence and foreign policy. And I think the way the AUKUS agreement is developing is really pretty good. Mm-hmm. So credit where it's due. Well done, Albanese government, on national security. Mm. The economy is a different matter altogether. sure, there will be a very modest surplus, it seems, tonight. Mm-hmm. But there are going to be substantial deficits as far as the eye can see. As I said, this is a one-off surplus produced by luck. It's not a sustained surplus produced by sound economic management.
Yeah.
And if you look at what the government has done over the last year or so, you've got price caps for gap on gas and coal. Yep. You've got 1970s-style re-regulation of workplace relations. You've got the energy policy disaster. Mm. I mean, probably the wackiest thing in the budget is going to be big handouts to families to compensate them for skyrocketing power prices when it's the government's policy, which is putting power prices through the roof because they're closing down reliable 24/7 coal-fired power to replace it with unreliable wind and solar power, which constantly needs backup. And this really is a problem that is very much of this government's making. And sure, you can say, oh, look, short-term factors associated with the Ukraine war have made it worse. Mm. I grant you that. Mm. But at the end of the day, we need a power supply which is absolutely reliable and affordable. And to get that now and for the foreseeable future, we are going to be dependent upon fossil fuels. And so we are really storing up massive problems for the near future because of this emissions obsession that the government is particularly prone to. Mm.
Just going back to the 2014 budget, can you help us understand some of the challenges that you faced as a prime minister and what your government faced? Because you did undertake some fairly far-reaching reforms. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of pushback from the Senate and also from sections of the community that were saying you were, cutting spending and, reducing welfare payments and so forth. And that meant that a significant majority of the budget measures that you had passed through the lower house ultimately did not succeed in the Senate. Can you tell us and talk us through some of the challenges that you faced there?
Well, first of all, Dan, could I just clear up some of the myths? It's a myth that promises were broken in the 2014 budget. It's a myth that spending was slashed. Mm. What happened was that we substantially reduced the rate of growth, but we did not go in and slash and burn. And in terms of spending on education and health, I had very clearly flagged and was heavily attacked for it during the 2013 election campaign that we were only committed to the Rudd-Gillard increases in spending for the then forward estimates.
Yep.
And sure, there was a significant reduction in the rate of growth in the 2014 budget in the final out year, but that was exactly what we had said we would do during the election campaign. And Joe Hockey and I were very, very careful throughout the period leading up to the 2014 budget not to break any election commitments. Now, sure, there were things in that budget that some people didn't like the Medicare co-payment, but we made no commitment not to have a Medicare co-payment. Overall, health spending continued to increase. Some of it was redirected from the sorts of things that Labor loves into the Health and Medical Research Future Fund. Education funding continued to increase, albeit at a slower rate, beyond the previous out years. We did try to get students to make a bigger contribution towards their university education.
Yep.
We did try to ensure that people would be more focused on work by saying to young people in particular, you can't leave school and go on the dole. You had to either learn or earn.
Mm.
But welfare for 18 and 19-year-olds was not an option.
Yep.
We did say that we were going to progressively raise the pension age from 67 that the Labor government had raised it to 70. That was one of the measures that was blocked in the Senate. But I guess the difference was that in opposition, we supported sensible changes by the Rudd-Gillard government. For instance, we supported the Gillard government's moving people off the parenting payment onto unemployment benefits once the youngest child reached 8, because we thought that the best form of welfare is work, and it's frankly better for the kids if mum or dad is in work rather than on a parenting payment. So look, we supported the sensible economic measures, not that there were that many of them, that Rudd-Gillard government took. Of course, Labor didn't return the favour when we were in government. Just as the Howard government had supported most of the Hawke the Howard opposition had supported most of the Hawke government's reforms, the Abbott opposition supported anything that genuinely was a reform from the Rudd-Gillard government, but Labor takes it when they're in government, but they don't give it when they're in opposition.
No, indeed, Tony. No, thank you. Thank you for that context and overview. I'd like to turn now to the situation in Victoria and the never-ending saga with Moira Deeming, and we've talked about this before. So to bring everybody up to date, there is going to be a second motion to expel Moira Deeming from the Parliamentary Liberal Party, which I believe is going to be held this Friday at a meeting. This comes after a meeting held a few weeks ago where there was originally going to be a motion to expel. During the course of that meeting, that option was shelved. The outcome was that Moira would be suspended for 9 months, whereupon, if she met some conditions, apparently she would re-enter the Parliamentary Party. There was confusion about the minutes of the meeting. Moira basically said that, "I'm looking into taking legal action in relation to being exonerated as a Nazi sympathiser." Then there was some pushback as a result of that. It's bizarre how we've gotten into this situation, but the long and short of it is that it looks like Moira Deeming will ultimately be expelled from the Parliamentary Liberal Party, which I think is a dramatic overreach by the Liberal Party leadership. Tony, could I just get your assessment of the current situation?
Well, remarkably, the minutes have been published. I don't quite know how they came to be published, but they have been published, and apparently this is the agreed minutes, not one version that's contested.
Yep.
But the minutes were published last week in the Australian newspaper, and the minutes of that meeting in late March provide for three things. First of all, they said that Moira would be suspended for 9 months.
Yep.
But it seems that there was an automatic readmission after 9 months.
Yep.
Second, that there would be a joint statement between Moira and the party leader clearing her. And third, there was this declaration that no one believes that Moira Deeming is a Nazi or a Nazi sympathiser. So those minutes are completely clear, Moira. And you've got to ask yourself, why is she even suspended, given that it's agreed by the party room and by John Pizzuto, she's not a Nazi or a Nazi sympathiser. So why can't she just stay in the party room as she was elected to do? Why can't that happen? Well, it seems that there's now this problem that some people think is very serious, that she was talking about some kind of legal action last week. Well, my understanding, gained from what I've read in the papers, is that she was trying to look at ways of getting John Pizzuto to honour his commitment to issue a public statement clearing her. Now, he finally did say in the media late last week that he doesn't believe that she's a Nazi or a Nazi sympathiser. But by gee, it took him 6 weeks to do what the party room minutes said he had agreed to do at the end of March. Now, why wouldn't Moira be looking at some way of extracting from the leader the exoneration that he'd promised to give her?
What should happen now in your view? I mean, it's not too late for this to be avoided. I mean, I think it looks like they're pretty committed to it, but what, I mean, I just think the whole thing should be withdrawn and they need to just work together.
Well, of course. Obviously, people inside the Parliamentary Liberal Party are entitled to have different views on different issues. But in the end, the whole point of being in a political party after you've been elected under the party banner is to work as constructively as you can with your fellow Liberals to bring about better government here in Victoria. Unfortunately, they've spent most of the last couple of months tearing themselves to pieces over something which we now say was not her fault and she was in no way complicit in because she's not a Nazi and she's not a Nazi sympathiser. So I think that what should happen is that everyone should, I think in the old days used to say, take a Bex and lie down. And I mean, if she was perfectly entitled to go to the rally in defence of women's rights, as she was, she didn't do anything wrong. If she had nothing to do with the neo-Nazi gate crashing of that event, she did nothing wrong. If it's agreed by the party room and by the leader, as it is, that she's not a neo-Nazi or a Nazi sympathiser, again, she's done nothing wrong. Let her sit in the party room as she was elected to do and do the best thing she can for the party and for the people of Victoria. That's what should happen. But if she is ultimately expelled from the party room, you'll have the very strange situation of a Liberal Party member not being able to sit with the Liberal Party in the Parliament. And a pretty clear message will have been sent to the people of Victoria that a forthright Conservative woman cannot be a member of the Parliamentary Liberal Party. Now, I thought we were supposed to be attracting women into public life, not saying to them, well, if you happen to be a Conservative woman, well, there's no place for you in the Liberal Party. I mean, surely it is the job of the Liberal Party to represent, amongst others, Conservative women, not exclusively Conservative women. As John Howard often said, our party is the custodian in this country of two political traditions, the small L Liberal tradition of John Stuart Mill and the small C Conservative tradition of Edmund Burke. Well, Moira Deeming appears to be more in the small C Burkean tradition than in the small L a million tradition, but there has got to be a place inside our broad church Liberal Party for small C Conservatives such as Moira Deeming. And if there isn't, I really do fear for the Liberal Party's future.
Yeah, and look, aside from Moira, there's also two other upper house MPs that have been targeted, Renee Heath and Bev MacArthur, both in the upper house and both women, and probably you'd say both on the conservative side of the spectrum. And it just comes across to me as, I mean, from my perspective, looking at this from the outside, that you have a new Liberal leader who's very self-conscious about his authority within the party and wanting to prove a point to the community. Mm-hmm. But surely, I mean, I understand that, but I mean, surely you're better off proving a point to the community mm-hmm. by taking the fight to Daniel Andrews and the Labor Party, which is overseeing, you know, the dramatic economic and financial dislocation of this state. Mm-hmm. But they're endless navel-gazing on this issue.
And frankly, the best thing the Liberal Party could do in this state right now, maybe more widely, is to say that the Liberal Party respects the right of women mm-hmm. to their own spaces. Mm. Now, it's not anti-trans to be pro-women. It's not anti-trans to say that biological men shouldn't be allowed into women's facilities. They just shouldn't, because women should be able to feel completely safe in their own facilities. And I would commend that thought to all leading Liberals.
Yeah. How would you have, I mean, you know, as leader of the Liberal Party and the coalition, I mean, you would have had to have managed a variety of different personalities and a variety of different styles. I think you did, you know, an overwhelmingly good job in managing that for a number of years. Well, I mean, how did you sort of go about managing, you know, there's ideological differences, but there's also temperamental differences. You've got ambitious people. Yeah. What's your sort of lessons of leadership in that space?
Dan, the best way to unite the Liberal Party is to pick a bloody big fight with the Labor Party.
And
that's the best way to unite the Liberal Party, and on a whole host of issues, but particularly border protection and the carbon and mining taxes, that's exactly what I did. Now, you'd think that there are all sorts of grounds on which to attack the Dan Andrews government. There's obviously a budget crisis. Mm-hmm. There's obviously mismanagement of the health system. He apparently wants to give public servants 5 days pay for 4 days work. Political correctness is completely rampant in Victoria, pushed by the Andrews government. You've got these injecting rooms that he wants to bring in, which he promised not to do previously. There are all these corruption issues that are dogging the government. This is a target-rich environment for a Liberal Party which wanted to go on the attack rather than simply engage in fratricidal cannibalism.
Look, I mean, just to round out the conversation, my view is that the next election really is up for grabs here at the state level. It might sound a bit outlandish, but this is ultimately, you know, as you'll know from politics, things go slowly then quickly. Mm-hmm. And if you can kind of keep prosecuting a case day after day, I think there's a real opportunity. But they need people like Moira in the party, because she is fearless. She will say things that other people will not. And I accept that Moira's views are not the views of everybody, but she has the capacity to reach an entirely new constituency, and she will do that in her own way, in her own style. And I just think people like Moira have to have a role in the Liberal Party.
But it shouldn't be contentious inside the Liberal Party that women have a right to their own safe spaces. Women should not have to have biological men coming into their change rooms, coming into their facilities. They just shouldn't have to have that thrust upon them. Now, Moira may well be more forthright in putting forward a view on this than others, but it should not be a contentious view inside the Liberal Party. It really should not. And to expel someone for stating something that really should be self-evident,
and that most people
I think
agree
is not only bizarre, it's an exercise in Stalinism.
Well, Tony, I think that's a pretty good note on where to lead the conversation. So thank you again for your insights and your thoughts and analysis, and we'll chat again in a couple of weeks.
We certainly will, Dan.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.